Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. Here at the Mediocre Movie Club, we are a group of friends, although none of them are with me tonight. I promise there are other people in this group besides me. You may have heard them if you continue to listen to our podcast. But tonight it's just me. We are a group of friends here at the Mediocre Movie Club. We select a group of three movies every month. We watch those three movies and post our reviews at mediocremovie.club. And at the end of the month, we get together to discuss those three movies. This last month, yikes. Two yikeses and one, I don't know, what's the opposite of yikes? Wow, I guess. Two yikes and one wow. We watched Into the Grizzly Maze, and we watched Night in Paradise, and we watched In the Mood for Love. So hopefully the tone of my voice reflects how I feel about these movies. I don't really know what happened this last month. In the Mood for Love, preview of my eventual breakdown of that film, is a great all-timer of a movie. The movies that are paired with it, however, what the fuck? So, I don't know. I'm fairly speechless. I've been fairly speechless about these movies, the selection, for about a month now. And I kind of am pushing the rest of the Mediocre Movie Club to perhaps recalibrate how we choose what movies to watch. But here nor there, this month, it is what it is. So, Into the Grizzly Maze. This is a movie directed by David Hackle. Okay, great, I hear ya. Who the fuck is that guy? You're right to be confused. He's a very thin resume on this guy. But the people who doesn't have a thin resume are the people in his cast. People like Thomas Jane. He just wants his kids back. And he's also a pretty good actor. Been in some good stuff. James Marsden. Piper Perabo. Billy Bob Thornton. Scott Glenn, Adam Beach. I think if you watched Into the Grizzly Maze, I think you witnessed an international crime taking place. Not because the movie is terrible, which it is. Full stop, it's bad. This is a jumped up Syfy original that was turned into, I want to say movie, but is it a movie if it receives no marketing budget? If it doesn't show up in theaters? If it just totally comes and goes, which leads me to think that this was part of a money laundering scheme. I think perhaps one of the dozen or so producers, I don't know if a dozen producers is a lot for a movie necessarily, but this movie has like a dozen producers. I don't know if one of the producers whose only other credit is Into the Grizzly Maze, and there were a few of them, of those 12, give or take, of those 12. I don't know if they have some kind of natural gas windfall, perhaps. Maybe just years of skimming off of various organized crime endeavors produced a big enough windfall that it needed to be moved into circulation. You know, you can only have so much cash on hand. And this is how they chose to do it. They put together actors who, you know, James Marsden, he's part of that superhero crowd, or formerly was. He was one of the original group, kind of, with the X-Men. Billy Bob Thornton has an Oscar. Thomas Jane starred he led a TV show. And Piper Perabo is, you know, a person who has acted in the stuff. I'm not exactly sure what, but if we selected her for the movie game, I would not be able to provide any answers for that. These are people that are expensive to work with. And if I was laundering money, what I would do is throw together a script. I'm doing air quotes. And I don't know, it's like filmed in a national forest, it seems. Bear wranglers cost a lot of money. Actors cost a lot of money. And then I would skimp on everything else. I would want it the least amount of eyes possible on this thing. But I would want to make it as expensive as possible. So as to, you know, wash my money through this cinematic con, and then it comes out, producer style, it's bad and it goes away, but the money's been spent. So, great. But then on the other hand, where does your money go? I don't know, maybe I don't know what money laundering is. Maybe I'm Skyler White in Breaking Bad, Googling how to money launder. and checking out the Wikipedia page. The point is, Into the Grizzly Maze just doesn't make sense as a movie. It doesn't make sense as a movie. It makes sense as an afternoon, tone down the violence a tiny little bit, maybe one less, maybe cut out like 3 seconds of Billy Bob Thornton's mauled face, and several more seconds of like Adam Beach's halved body. Was his body halved? I don't know. There was somebody's body got halved in this movie. And sippy afternoon movie, and then you're done. I'm upset that I watched this. I wish that it was fun, at least, as a man versus nature horror slash monster movie. It's not. It's there are just few redeeming qualities to this. There's a lot of very cheap characterization. You know, the classic screenwriting tool of save the cat. You know, you have to demonstrate that your protagonist is a good person right off the bat. So you would do that by, say, perhaps having him, pull a cat out of a tree, or however a person would save a cat that was in danger, that needed a human's help. Here the cat is a prostitute who's being abused by her pimp slash boyfriend that James Marsden rescues. Neither of those characters show up again. But, of course, in this metaphor, the cat also has to lift up its shirt and show its breasts just because we want to titillate the audience, but we also want to demonstrate our protagonist's goodness through the walking prop that is this character, who we also asked, you know, to include some nudity in the film. That's how you start off. And before even that, you're starting off with this flashback of these two children who will grow up to be James Marsden and Thomas Jane, brothers, traipsing through the woods, and it sure seems like the same bear that is terrorizing the grizzly maze of the title. It sure seems like that's the same bear, maybe? Was that supposed to be the same bear? I don't know, because this bear attacks these small children, and cut away before anything is resolved. Did one brother save the other? I think that's what happened. It's shot in this puke green filter. David Hackle, what are you doing? You're just so poisoning the well so quickly. It just becomes impossible to redeem yourself. Poor Adam Beach as this, I guess you would say, like, town dirtbag. Everybody kind of knows that he is involved in every shady aspect of this small town, which it doesn't make him necessarily, you know, the worst person in the world by any means. But if there's some dirt going down in this town, which, you know, abuts a national forest, which means, you know, poaching, specifically for the in the case of this movie, just, I mean, poor Adam, again, just the actor and the character as well are just so ill-served by this movie. He, you know, sells his soul to bring these voracious poachers who are just stacking up bears, bear corpses, in their forest poaching haven. He changes his mind. They fight the bear. The angry, vengeful bear who's been driven mad by, we'll say, deforestation. It's quite muddy, if this movie means anything or is about anything. This bear, you know, attacks this group, and the last we see of Adam Beach, he's fleeing. But then we eventually find his body, and he's been killed. He may have died as a result of the fight with his poacher accomplices. Anyways, but it all happened off screen. Like, he climbed a tree and the bear finished the job. He's like fifth or sixth build in this movie. Why wouldn't you include that scene of terror? I mean, it's easy to imagine, like, fighting in vain to fend off this monstrous bear, who, P.S., is the best part of the movie, Bart the Bear 2. great job for him and his trainer slash wrangler. I give no credit to Hackle. He didn't direct the bear. It was all the wrangler. But, I mean, the bear is ferocious and the bear is humongous. But yeah, then we just return to this place, and what do you know? Adam Beach has died off screen. He was in the movie for like 3 or 4 minutes. We spent the last month, some portion of it, talking about Godzilla vs. Kong and Mortal Kombat. In no universe are those, you know, high-quality movies that are about some aspect of the human condition. But at least they had some sense of what they were and, like, really heavily leaned into it. You know, the Grizzly Maze is just a series of things that happen. And this will come up again with Night in Paradise. It just doesn't have... These movies, at their base, are supposed to be fun. Because what they can't... If they're not going to be in any way... I guess the difference between the gray trailer and the gray movie, I guess I would say. The gray trailer hints at a movie where Liam Neeson is going to fight wolves with, like, broken glass taped to his knuckles. And that scene exists in the gray movie. But, you know, that's also about... death and the inevitability of it, and the flimsy, finite nature of human life. Liam Neeson fighting wolves would have been a fun movie, but the movie that The Gray actually is a lot more fun. Is a much better movie. It's a better film. Whereas Into the Grizzly Maze can't even reach the level of fun hinted at by the gray trailer. All these actors are really wasted. With a couple of exceptions, Billy Bob Thornton's death is well edited, I would say. There's just a nice little moment of him recognizing what's about to happen to him. He, a grizzled old professional bear hunter. And James Marsden gives some amount of backstory that is far more interesting about his family and his relationship with Thomas Jane and their father. That is several degrees more interesting than the movie that is Into the Grizzly Maze. So it's not a complete disaster, and I praised the bear, but just what a waste. What a waste. I hope some Eastern European mobster, you know, got his money's worth. And I would say got to meet some people on the red carpet, but that implies that this movie follows any predictable release path that one would expect from movies. Which it doesn't. Which I can't imagine that it did. So, Into the Grizzly Maze, a movie that exists. This is a D. There's obviously no one to play the movie game with. And in the period of time when I knew I would be doing this podcast by myself, there's just no good option. I can't just sit here trying to remember stuff. I will occasionally play the movie game by myself, like on a car ride, or I'm stuck in traffic, or occasionally when I'm trying to go to sleep, but that's for me. And in the case of, you know, trying to go to sleep, like if I'm successful at it, I'll kind of drift off. So that doesn't exactly sound like good radio. A process that helps me fall asleep. So, no interstitials between movies, all the better, just to hurry the process of erasing these movies from my mind. I'm never going to think about Into the Grizzly Maze after this podcast is recorded and edited, and hopefully I'll never think about our next movie, Night in Paradise, after discussing it either, because I disliked this movie more than Into the Grizzly Maze. And over the course of the next few minutes, maybe I can talk out, because I, you know, when I write reviews, I don't compare movies we're talking about in rounds together unless there's some kind of theme, and we don't really do that here at the American Movie Club. Let's see if I can't talk out why exactly that is. Into the Grizzly Maze has essentially just no aspirations other than to be not even pulpy, just trashy. Other than to be trashy, I would say. Whereas Night in Paradise, directed by Park Hoon-joon, This is a South Korean gangster movie this is a 2021 release. It came out on Netflix after being released in South Korea. This movie has aspirations. This movie clearly has some level of cinematic goals, has some level of aesthetic goals. In its head, I would imagine it wants to be about something. It wants to be about revenge and fatalism. But the presence of those aspirations and the movie's complete failure in achieving them made me actively angry at this movie in a way that few movies do. Night in Paradise confuses meaning with pauses, in the sense that it wants to convince the viewer that a character is being wise and meaningful based on how long it takes him to complete a sentence. And the experience of that was just physically painful. This is a 131-minute long movie that has about 80 minutes worth of plot. And most of it happens in the first 20 minutes. This is about a mid-level gangster rising in the ranks. He's got people under him. He's got people above him. And he has offered a buyout, I guess you would say, from a rival gang. And he turns it down out of loyalty to his boss. And the character's name is Park Tae-gu, played by Eun Tae-gu. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I apologize to any South Korean listeners if I'm not, which I'm surely not. And shortly thereafter, Park's sister and niece are killed in a car accident off screen. And he is prodded to take revenge on the likely culprit, namely the crime boss who offered him, you know, a buyout. He makes an attempt on his life, kills several henchmen. Crime boss lives. But in the meantime, Park needs to take refuge in an island for a period of time until his exodus from South Korea to Russia can be arranged. And the bulk of the movie takes place on this island where just nothing is happening. Back on the mainland, Park's boss makes a splashed over attempt to enlarge his territory that fails for unclear reasons. The underlings of the wounded boss are quite angry. It turns out that Park's boss set up this entire thing from start to finish. It's interminable. It's just so interminable. And then on the island, Park, he starts a relationship with the woman who, oh, no, with the niece of the man who he's holed up with. She's got a terminal disease. And they go back and fucking forth about, I guess you would say, what makes life meaningful. Although for her, it's at this point, you know, a bowl of good fish soup from her favorite restaurant. I hated this. I hated this movie. It just is so, 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 so slow and unmotivated. Everybody, it's not a surprise that Park's boss is revealed to be, you know, the ultimate culprit. But the movie drags out his eventual comeuppance by just constantly referencing all of his allies and official circles. And what it does instead is just take every opportunity for characters to repeat themselves about how slimy and gross this boss is. And it's just the same line over and over and over again. He can't defend himself because he ordered the, you know, the assassination of a little girl, effectively. and he's undercut, and he's like dishonored his whole specific crime family by performing this ruse. And the characters just, no one can touch this guy. The obvious result is, like, immediately get rid of him. Like, you arranged a hit on my boss. We're in gangland South Korea. Enough. This has been decided. Like, why would we... These extended negotiation scenes happening back on the mainland while Park and this female character, Kim, are just banally talking about whatever it is they're talking about. There are what negotiations? He needs to be discarded. The fight needs to be between Park and the people that he offended. And we do eventually get that. Like, everything happens in Night in Paradise that one would expect to happen. But the action is no good. The action makes little sense. There aren't cool sequences because the standard for this kind of, like, gangland, Yakuza-esque or Yakuza-ish, these kind of gangland war movies that take place in Hong Kong or Singapore or Indonesia or Korea or South Korea or wherever, the bar has been set so high by much, much, much better filmmakers than Park Hoon-joon that it's all just so perfunctory and uninspired, and this whole movie is just going through the motions, and it's just a pathetic attempt to dress up what little is here. Just irked me to no end. It's pretty rare for me to get really worked up angrily about anything. I'm passionate, no question, but I'm not an angry person in general. This movie really made me angry. Like, it really made me yell around my house at, like, 2 o'clock in the morning or whenever it was that I was watching this movie. And I was just enraged. I was enraged by how long it was taking. And this movie, unlike Into the Grizzly Maze, this is a movie that is, in fact, a movie. Like, it was released in South Korea, competed at film festivals, all this bullshit, lots of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's complete pretentious bullshit. Pretentious isn't the right word. Playing at meaning. While being about nothing, the movie ends with a suicide, and I can't think of anything more appropriate for a movie as empty as this, that for all the characters are dead, and nothing has been accomplished, and that's it. Roll credits. End movie. Night in Paradise fucking sucked. Night in Paradise, I would rather watch Into the Grizzly Maze than this. Because as bad as Into the Grizzly Maze is, it wasn't a painful experience. It was a nothing experience. This was painful in how it gets dragged out at every opportunity. D fucking minus. One of the worst movies I've seen in some time. A true dog. And this was on my radar too, so I'm not as upset about watching this as I was about Grizzly or Into the Grizzly Maze. So that's a point in Night in Paradise's favor. I would have, on a long enough time scale, I would have eventually got to this movie. It was on the list. But I guess better late than never. I'd never have to see it crop up in my Letterboxd list as I prune those watch lists over what I have yet to watch. I can record this podcast, I can edit this podcast, and I can never think about Night in Paradise again. This movie sucked. On the almost polar opposite end of the spectrum is our final movie, In the Mood for Love by Wong Kar-wai. This has been widely recognized as the best movie of the 21st century. This movie is the highest ranked 21st century release on the Sight and Sound 10-year annual or 10-year list of lists assembled by Sight and Sound magazine. Ranked number 24, well above the next contender, which I don't think there was another one in the top 100, which would have been Mulholland Drive. Deserving, also totally fair. There'll be another one of those lists out in 2022. I'm very excited about that. And I gotta say, this is my fourth time seeing In the Mood for Love, and it is justifiably praised, if that's the level. Like, I don't have any, I wouldn't quibble with anybody if I ran into someone that's like, what's the best movie? Let's rank movies of the 21st century. In the Mood for Love, number one, fine. Totally fine. There's probably like several dozen. There's probably like a few dozen, two or three dozen totally acceptable answers to that question. And yeah, In the Mood for Love would be in like dozen number one. Like on my personal top movies of all time, an A+ is an A+, whatever that means, you know, specific to me. But within that grade, I break things down by, like in my head, is this a subjective opinion? Because once you cross an A threshold, you're really into like specific personal reactions that I would have had to this movie, because you can't break up that into that A level without some kind of reaction. Most often like an emotional, romantic one. Well, in the case of In the Mood for Love, romantic one, capital R romantic, objective and subjective A pluses. Kill Bill, that's a subjective A plus. I understand that movie is not like a flawless diamond, start to finish. And I also understand that very few people would name that as their favorite Tarantino, much less one of their favorite, if not their favorite, then one of their favorite movies of all time. Subjective. In the Mood for Love, objective. Like, this is a perfect movie. This is a perfect movie. So intimately considered in every detail. Angles, wardrobe, dialogue, acting, everything is purposeful in this movie, and it all works into this just like achingly beautiful tribute to like missed opportunities, lost loves, the ethereality of just like human interactions and humans like just passing each other at specific moments in time. The window where, you know, like alternate universes can be created. Like, if I take a step in one direction, my life could potentially be totally different. And not only the kind of wonder at that, but like the nostalgia and the pain of knowing that you approached a moment like that and chose not to take the step. It's just beautiful. You can, if you eschew all the meaning that a person could take out of In the Mood for Love, I feel like just the average viewer would have to say this movie just looks incredible from start to finish. It sounds incredible. Wong Kar-wai cast two of the most beautiful people in the world at that time, and maybe still, in Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung. Both these like pinnacle human specimens, and proceeds to spend the next 95 minutes, you know, not putting them together. So it seems like the most natural thing in the world that these two otherworldly people would get together, and this would be, you know, it, like the movie about their a worse director. Potentially, in a worse writer, like their meet cute and their inevitable realization that they're married to the wrong people and they're supposed to be the ones that are together. But in fact, that's not how this movie goes. There's nothing even close to a consummation of a romantic relationship. There's a confession of feelings, but more importantly, there's the acknowledgement that that based on their shared experience, this just cannot happen. So, just some background about Wong Kar-wai and my experience with Wong Kar-wai. I've seen maybe half of his movies. I don't... He is, without a doubt, one of the most respected filmmakers working today. He hasn't made a movie in some time, since 2012's The Grandmaster, which is very good. Chopped to shit by Harvey Weinstein and dumped down for American audiences. I recently saw the Chinese cut of that in its original Wong Kar-wai approved format, and quite good. Quite good. A really impressive martial arts movie while also having that same sense of intimacy and beauty that Wong Kar-wai brings to at least the movies that I've seen of his, and I would imagine it stays true for his eight or nine or so movies. In the Mood for Love specifically comes in 2000, right in the middle of his career. This is the second of an unofficial trilogy. Days of Being Wild, one of his earlier films from the early 1990s, that has a character played by Maggie Cheung who shares a name with her character and In the Mood for Love, although whether or not, you know, he had that idea in his head in making Days of Being Wild to you know, eventually revisit, I don't have her name is Sue in the movie, to revisit Sue, specifically, who knows. And then in 2046, some period of time after In the Mood for Love, I want to say 2006, 2007, that is a movie that imagines Tony Leung character Chow as reverting back to like a playboy in the aftermath of this failed relationship, failed opportunity with Sue after In the Mood for Love. I've seen about half of that movie, and then for whatever reason, I just didn't get through the second half. Wong Kar-wai's movies frequently have, and I've seen, you know, half of 2046, so not really any of it without having that full picture. But I have seen Chungking Express, and I have a sense of his other movies. And his trademarks, beyond just that aforementioned sensuality and just really calculated composition of his works, what makes him, or what he repeatedly comes back to, is like a broken narrative, multiple characters. The movie can suddenly become about a character who's like far down, perceivedly far down on the call sheet, and then all of a sudden, this next like 20 minutes is about them, and that can be a little off-putting, a little distancing, and I think In the Mood for Love works for me so much better than a movie like Chungking Express, which, in fairness, I should probably watch again before I like can completely form an opinion on. I haven't seen that movie in some time. Before I started writing reviews about everything I watched, that was when I saw Chungking Express, and I don't have too great of a memory of it here or there, but I do remember thinking that movie was fine. But In the Mood for Love, in the way that it solely focuses on Sue and Chow, to the exclusion of all others, like there's barely a third character in this movie, maybe Sue's landlord, maybe Chow's horny coworker. It really exists in the hotel room where they work on this martial arts serial, in their apartment building, in the hallway that they pass each other on their way from, you know, late night solitary dinners. This is a movie that is really laser focused on Sue and Chow, and so much the better for it. I mentioned in my review that this is the kind of movie that really grows on you. This is the fourth time I've seen it. And I was wary for any kind of downgrade from the A-plus that I finally landed on after my third time seeing it. And like, for example, when we recently discussed The Social Network at Munich Movie Club, I downgraded that to an A just because the line... specifically about The Social Network, just sidebar, the line between the character's misogyny, which I thought was appropriate for the movie, bled a little bit into the misogyny of the movie itself, which, you know, written by Aaron Sorkin, that's something you have to be on the lookout for him with his with the way that he writes. And I felt well, that I felt in this latest viewing of The Social Network that the movie was getting a little misogynist as opposed to its characters. So downgrade. And I was on the lookout within The Mood for Love for any kind of similar downgrade. Because for a movie to be an A+, as I said with Kill Bill, it doesn't necessarily mean the movie has to be perfect. But it does need to be in that highest echelon of some kind of response, whether it be emotional, whether it be intellectual, whether it be both, whether it be more, whether it be just be purely visceral, whatever, but it's got to be in that highest echelon. And when I say that In the Mood for Love, you know, for the second time in a row, just left me just shattered by the end of it, and just like a very specific version of movie crying where it's not like creeping up on you, it's not like a constant state of like wet eyes, lump in the throat. It just really, the experience of really connecting within the movie of love is getting to the end, and all of a sudden, really, almost out of nowhere, you are just broken down by the end of it. It's almost at the same moment, too, and a more cynical viewer might say this is like hacky screenwriting, where you hear Chow talk about this Cambodian process of, or this Cambodian custom of going to one of these old temples and whispering a secret in a hole and covering it up with soil or mud or whatever. And then he does that a few minutes later, maybe 10 minutes later, and it's the last thing that happens in the movie. And it's been consistently at that moment where he does the thing he was just talking about, and it is so meaningful and heartbreaking that even if you've been fairly placid throughout the rest of that movie, just by the time that finale, that final scene comes up, you are just shattered. And that was the experience again. So it just locks in the A+. To get away from like the romantic angle, there is also this middle-aged aspect to In the Mood for Love, where both of these characters are really going through the motions. They don't have anything, really. They're renting rooms and apartments. I'm not up on the 1960s real estate market in Hong Kong. I would imagine it's not dissimilar from, you know, 2020s version of real estate in Hong Kong, which I would imagine is a disaster and impossible. But both of these characters are white-collar workers who are doing, in Sue's case, she's a secretary, or she's like an administrative assistant, or some kind of secretary type position, or executive or receptionist type position for it doesn't really matter. I mean, that's really all you need to know about her. She's not in control, and works long hours for her boss, doesn't seem to take a lot out of it, doesn't take a sense of accomplishment or much satisfaction, whereas he is a journalist for what seems like an unserious, if not an unserious paper, then he is, it's just not what they want to be doing in both their cases. And you see them bond over perhaps writing like these kung fu serials, these martial arts serials. And in the exact same way that the movie is about this failed relationship, it's also about like failed ambition or thwarted ambition or a life on autopilot, and this potential, this like really, this bittersweet potential, because the instigating incident of the movie is that as these two couples, Sue and her husband and Chow and his wife, move into the same apartment complex, off screen, we never see their respective spouses, but Sue's husband and Chow's wife start an off-camera affair, And Sue and Chow kind of both realize it at the same time and take solace with each other. It's not necessarily that they're so in love with their cheating spouses. It's more that it's one more thing, it's one more arena of their life that is not working. And in meeting their counterpart, Sue and Chow, professionally and romantically, just are able to catch a glimpse of a better version of their lives. One where they're more happy in their marriages, more happy in their love lives, more happy professionally, fulfilled professionally, have a sense of creating something, as opposed to just being like caught up in the constant workflow of journal. You don't get the sense that Chow is like breaking big stories in his job, and you don't get the sense that Sue is working on these big projects. It's just day to day, go in, go home, work like a 12-hour day, and walk down the street to grab some late night takeout. Don't hang out with your very friendly tenants. This is also something the movie does very well, is just communicate the community. A small community, it's just the two families that live next door to each other, but they have regular mahjong dates and regular dinners, and they're separated, but they're living communally, and it's very appealing. But Sue and Chow both keep those potential arrangements at arm's length. They're regularly invited, but they just don't go. Maybe because they're too tired from working so much at jobs they don't really like. And just again, in The Mood for Love, there's just so many ways into it if you're not connecting necessarily to the romantic part, which again, I don't know why you wouldn't, because if I haven't mentioned, these are two of the most beautiful people that have ever graced any screen ever. Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung. Last thing to say about In the Mood for Love, it's a surprise. It was a surprise to me to find that the central theme of the movie, the theme that accompanies this In the Mood for Love's iconic interstitials of like a slow motion hero walks, characters just thinking. I mean, I talked about Night in Paradise being a movie that takes its time for no reason. In the Mood for Love takes its time for a reason. To slow everything down so you can really observe the nuance in the actors' faces, where they're going, etc. But the song that accompanies that is from an earlier movie called Yumeji, and it's Yumeji's theme. Shocked that this wasn't an original piece of music composed for In the Mood for Love, because it fits so perfectly, it's associated so intimately in my head. I researched how to find that music for a ringtone on my clamshell flip phone. Unsuccessfully, I never did it. But it's absolutely one of my favorite movie pieces. And what do you know? Wong Kar-wai just pulled it out of another movie. He's not a precious guy, apparently, which I really appreciate. Like, it's... There's obviously, like, the comparison would be, like, pulling... like, Hannibal Lecter's theme, for example, is some piece of classical music. And I don't know what it is, but I strongly associate it with him, that character. And that's been the case across multiple properties and multiple characters playing Hannibal Lecter. But just the idea that... like the score for Braveheart would be repurposed or something like that would be repurposed into another movie is hard to imagine, but somehow Wong just makes it work, as everything works in In the Mood for Love, which is to say perfectly. This remains a perfect movie. This remains a movie that I feel like I have devalued by placing it in anywhere near the same conversation as Into the Grizzly Maze and Night in Paradise. Sorry, Wong Kar-wai. Sorry, Tony Leung. Sorry, Maggie Cheung. My bad. Media Community Club's bad. A+. Watch In the Mood for Love. Currently on HBO Max. I'm not even going to say. It's easy to find out where Into the Grizzly Maze and Night in Paradise are. I'd rather not say, because I don't want to plug them. Don't waste your fucking time. Spend a lot of time within the Mood for Love. watch it once, watch it twice. I watched it four times. It took me three for it to really, really click in as the perfect movie that it is. Again, yes, A+. One of the better movies we've ever done. Well, just automatically because of its A+ grade. Automatically one of the better movies we've ever done on the Munich Movie Club. Glad I watched it. Not happy I watched the other two movies. Those fucking sucked. Our next three movies for the upcoming month are The Mitchells vs. the Machines, Tenet, and St. Maud, all recent releases. Should have a lot to say about all of those. I know Pierce especially is quite eager to talk about Tenet. I think he felt about the same as I felt about Night in Paradise, as opposed to Into the Grizzly Maze. I think it made him actively angry, but we'll have to wait about a month to see. We'll be posting reviews of those movies, and as well as these last three movies, and many, many more, at MunichMovie.club. Like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movical. Instagram, Munich Movie Club. Jared does a very good job of posting all our reviews there. And I'm John_Kissel at Letterboxd.com. Very happy with that site. Gotta love it. One of my favorite places on the internet. Follow me there for smaller reviews of movies, as well as anything published on MunichMovie.club. I will usually say thank you for joining me tonight, but again, there was nobody here. I hope my fellow club mates watch In the Mood for Love and leave the entry for Night in Paradise and Into the Grizzly Maze blank on our master spreadsheet, which I had no reason to consult because, again, we didn't play the movie game. Thank you for listening. We appreciate any patronage that we get here at the Munich Movie Club. The most important thing is that I get to talk about movies with people I like, and I successfully talked about movies at least tonight for about 51 minutes. So thank you again for listening, and we hope to see you next month. Bye.